Good morning.
Good morning.
And good morning. So this morning I'm going to talk about... Is this mic on? Can you guys hear me? So this morning I'm going to talk... I'm going to give my second talk on the Genjo Koan by Dogen from the 13th century. I'm going to be giving some talks on Dogen for a while. And I gave my first one 3 weeks ago. So I'm going to be talking from the first paragraph of the Genjo Koan, which is in the front of your program, and I'll read it out loud, first of all. When all things, parentheses, dharmas, are the Buddha Dharma, there are enlightenment and delusion, practice, birth, death, Buddhas, and creatures. And when the 10,000 dharmas are without self, there are no delusion, no enlightenment, no Buddhas, no creatures, and no birth and death. The Buddha way transcends being and non-being. Therefore, there are birth and death, delusion and enlightenment, creatures and Buddhas. Nevertheless, flowers fall with our attachment, and weeds spring up with our aversion. Simple, right? We studied this in our morning study group. I was going to spend a couple weeks on it, but I think we ended up spending 6 weeks on it, and we should go back and spend another 60 weeks on it. I'm talking about the whole thing, not just this paragraph, but the whole essay. Okay, so I'm going to first talk about I'm going to talk about two interpretations of this. First, briefly, I'm going to talk about a developmental interpretation. Progressive developmental interpretation. Many of you are already familiar with the Zen saying, first, mountains and mountains. Mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers and valleys are valleys. Then, mountains are no longer mountains, rivers are no longer rivers, valleys are no longer valleys. Finally, mountains are mountains, rivers are rivers, and valleys are valleys. So the progressive interpretation, there's an echo of that ancient Chinese saying in the progressive interpretation, the developmental interpretation. So the developmental interpretation is, well, we just start, here we are, you know, we feel kind of cut off from each other. Sometimes we have relationships, sometimes we don't. Sometimes things go okay, sometimes they don't. We feel limited by our bodies and by our past and by our sense of self, and we worry, and we start practicing. Hopefully, if we can practice, we can get to the second developmental stage, since there are only three. There aren't a whole bunch. So we practice so that we can be free from all of these labels, be free from all of this inner turmoil, inner dialogue, until we get a taste of there are mountains are not mountains, rivers are not rivers, valleys are not valleys. It's just all here. You don't have to divide it up. But then the next developmental stage is to come back right here. Then we can get stuck at any of those levels, and we can also get stuck at the first one. And we do. And we can regress. So when I gave the last talk about Genjo Koan, I talked about myself years ago when I actually regressed. Of course, you have to have something to regress to. But I've been practicing really, really sincerely. I thought I was being sincere anyway. And I had a big opening where Tim seemed to fall away and things seemed to be just wonderful. Everything was not separate from anything else. And then I just skipped off to Minnesota from California with my wife and young child. We just skipped off. Didn't need any Buddha, Dharma, or Sangha. And as I said in my talk last time, then I was really in a state of spiritual intoxication, which we call God realm in Buddhism. God realm. And the higher you up, the farther, the quicker and faster you fall in Buddhism. So I was actually living in northern Minnesota. I won't say how I got there, but I was living in northern Minnesota with my family. And my sister called me from California and said that my other sister had had a psychotic break and that they didn't know what to do with her. Nobody knew what to do with her. And I wasn't even sure. I'd read about psychotic breaks, but I also heard about the myth of mental illness. This was a long time ago, you know. A long, long time ago. I just read a book on the myth of mental illness. And so I said to my, and my sister was beside herself, and she said my mother was beside herself, and, well, I can handle anything, right? we're all nothing separate, we're all one, we're all in this together, so send her out. send her out. So, and Yvette said, really, Tim? I said, sure. I said, you know, we meditate every day, twice a day. She can meditate with us. We grow our own food. She can grow food with us. Send her out. Well, my God realm got hit bad, right? Hit bad like a tanker, like a truck hit me. And I went right down, completely. I didn't know what to do. Wasn't even the sister I remembered. The sister I remembered seemed to be gone. This person who looked like my sister. But so it was very, very hard for me. No meds in those days, especially in the counterculture. No meds. Because, you know, we wanted to be real, right? Or something. So I regressed to the first stage. I regressed. So that's just an example of developmental of a developmental regression. But I'm not going to talk anymore about the developmental, the progressive stages, because I don't think that's really what Dogen is talking about here. Although it's talked about a lot in Buddhism, in Zen. I think his interpretation is actually a little different. I think his interpretation is that in each sentence in that paragraph, he's showing the Dharma. Just each sentence. That he's not talking about a progression. And I think that for two reasons. I'm not sure, and we spent time on this in our morning study group. I'm not sure. But I think this for two reasons. For one, this Zen teacher, who is our original Zen teacher in our lineage, doesn't favor what we call stepladder Zen, right? He doesn't favor taking a developmental, progressive approach to our practice. And you guys who've been with me for a long time know why he doesn't favor it, because then we get caught on comparing the rung of the ladder that we're on with the rung we'd like to be on with the rung we've been on before. And pretty soon, we're falling off that ladder. And it's not so much to say that there isn't some developmental process. It's that if you think too much that way, you're really not able just to give yourself to what your activity is, to what your life is. So I tend to think he didn't mean that. Although there's something to that too. And the other reason I tend to think he didn't mean that is that he starts this first sentence is very powerful. It's not really an introduction. It says, when all things are the Buddha Dharma, when all things. So the Buddha, actually it says, when all dharmas are the Buddha Dharma. That's very confusing to people, but he's using dharmas in two different ways here. Small d dharmas and capital D dharmas. A small d dharma is an experiential moment. So in Buddhism, there are no things. There are only experiential moments. But a translation is when all things, so you won't get mixed up. And you know, all those of you who practice Buddhism, you know when there aren't things in Buddhism, because how can there be things when there's just this continual unfolding? The moment you even say unfolding, there's not an unfolding, because we want to reify. So there are no things, there are just dharmas. And when all these experiential moments are as they are the Buddha Dharma. That is, they are the big Dharma, the capital D Dharma, which means the law of causality, the law of conditionality, that everything is the cause and the effect of everything else. Everything that happens to you was caused by everything else that happened to you and to those who interacted with you, and it's going to be the effect of everything. So that's the law, and the law says, this Buddhist law, like a billiard table, a huge billiard table that's millions of miles wide, and each ball is hitting the other balls, and those are hitting the other balls, and those are hitting the other balls. In each of those experiential moments when two balls hit each other is a dharma, a small dharma, an experiential moment. But the big dharma, the Buddha dharma, is the law that that's the way it is. But it takes a lot of maturity, actually. I mean, you can say when each experiential moment is the Buddha dharma, but to actually go with that, to actually get that, because we think that some of our experiential moments can't be the Buddha dharma. They're too messed up. They're too depressed. They're too confused. They're too frenetic. How can those be the Buddha dharma? We want the real dharma. Don't you want the real dharma? Maybe Tim can show you the real dharma. Or maybe Tim can. Reb can show you the real dharma. You've been waiting for Reb. Maybe he'll give you the real dharma. But Dogen says, what does he say, you guys? He says, all dharmas, all experiential moments, all of them, are the Buddha dharma, are the unfolding of life, the unfolding of cause and effect and cause and effect and cause and effect. Early Buddhists divided up the dharmas into good dharmas and bad dharmas, into wholesome dharmas and unwholesome dharmas. And Dogen is very, very specifically saying that's a real limitation. It's a limitation that gets us all in trouble. All in a lot of trouble. So, that means that whatever happens to us, if we radically accept it, then we see that it's what is. And this radical acceptance is what's called for in this teaching, in this practice. And there is always a teaching in our negative dharmas, in our negative experiential moments, in our painful experiential moments, in our discouraged experiential moments. Of course, there's a teaching in our positive ones, too, but you know the teaching there. It's the negative ones that you don't believe there's a teaching. You believe you have to change. But there's the teaching there. That's there. It's coming up. You don't know what it is. You don't need to know what it is, but it's a teaching. Because it's one of the balls hitting the other ball. And that's the whole universe interacting. So that, and if you hate it, then there's something that shows something about you and about your inability to just to at this moment to open up to the whole thing. So, in my own case with my sister, it was certainly a teaching that I didn't want. I didn't think of it as we don't think of these things as teachings when they happen. Unless you come and talk to your Zen teacher, he would probably say something that you don't appreciate about that. teaching for me was that I needed to get back to a sangha and a teacher and a practice I was doing practice on my own, but it was very much sort of intoxicated practice, intoxicated with. Something wonderful, but not dealing with the hard realities of suffering. And then later, much later, that teaching of my experience with my sister, it informed my professional life. I never knew it would, but years later, it came to inform my professional life for 20 years, and still is informing my professional life. So, and that was after I had sent my sister back to California and gone and said, Katagiri, help, help. Help, help. So, then this first sentence actually is the whole thing. It's one way of talking about the whole thing. Seeing that that negative dharma is a teaching is pretty hard. And lots of times we don't. Lots of people have had a lot of suffering in their lives, a lot of heartaches, and they develop an embittered crust. They develop a sardonic crust, a sarcastic crust, and a bitter crust, a misanthropic crust, a curmudgeon crust. You get the idea? Or they develop what? Some kind of Pollyannish denial, optimistic denial. We go either of those ways, naturally. Some people go the more the curmudgeon way. I know more of the curmudgeon way, people. But in our Zazen, we have this opportunity always to come back to this experiential moment and just see what it has to show us. See what it has to show us. So, that's the first sentence. When all things are the Buddha Dharma, there are enlightenment and delusion, practice, birth, death, Buddhas and dharmas. Buddhas and creatures. And then the next one, which is not a progression, I think that's what he's saying, at least, but rather another way of talking about this reality, the same reality, is when the 10,000 dharmas are without self, there are no delusion, no enlightenment, no Buddhas, no creatures, and no birth and death. That one is talking about stillness, talking about radically accepting too, but radically accepting things as they are without having to label them, without having to label, this is the teaching. Oh, this should be a great teaching. Well, this minute you say to that, you're clamping down on trying to get something, on trying to do something. Yeah, sure, it'll be a teaching for you, but just be light about it. Don't try to find the teaching, because it's all the teaching. Remember, it's a billiard table that's, 1,000 miles long by 1,000 miles wide, and just two of the billiard balls are hitting each other and then hitting all the other billiard balls. There we are. So, without the self, we let go of labels. We let go of discriminating between teaching and not teaching. And we notice that our labels really get in our way, and we're able to be free of them. Be free of them. Let them come and let them go. And then the third line, the Buddha way transcends being and non-being. Therefore, there are birth and death, delusion and enlightenment, creatures and Buddhas. And that one, some roshis say, is a synthesis of the first two. Hegel talked about thesis, antithesis, synthesis. But that's, again, more progressive. I don't believe that. What is there to synthesize? We don't have to bring anything together. It's already here. Our mind would like to synthesize things. We'd like to bring, oh, Tim said this, and then he said that. How can I? Well, our mind wants to do that, but everything is already together. We don't have to synthesize. So I quibble with that Roshi. I'd like to see that Roshi in my room upstairs and see what happens. Who knows? You never know. Instead, it's a metaphor about the fact that the first line, everything is separate, and the second line, there isn't anything to be separate, are just two ways of talking about the same big reality, the same great big reality. And the Mahayana scriptures talk a lot about the metaphor, which I've talked about here, of ocean and waves. So the first line, enlightenment, delusion, practice, birth, death, Buddhas and creatures, waves. Each of those is a wave. The second line, no Buddhas, no people, no Tim, no Rosemary, no Guy, no Ben. Ocean, ocean. But ocean or waves? Waves or ocean? So why don't we just do a little surfing? And of course you'd like to wait for the surf to get down before you surf, but the surf is always up. Sorry. The surf is always up. I mean, I've been sitting for a long time. I'll tell you. The surf, it subsides for a while. Just subside with it, but it'll be up again. It'll be up again soon. Because there's always some experiential moment that grates. There's always a grating experiential moment you didn't expect. For me, until 2 years ago, I was very healthy. I worked out all the time, stress-free. And all of a sudden, I've been in the hospital, I've been sick, I've been, God, can I even see my grandson? I don't even do this retreat. Is it all kinds of new experiential moments for me. Wow-wee. New waves, new forms of ocean coming up. And there'll be times when there's a wonderful lull. That's good. And your zazen can be nice and smooth. But what about when the surf's up? Can you just be here with it? That's our practice, just to be here with it. Because it's all the ocean. It's all the ocean. So how do we go through the practice? This practice. Well, Dogen's last sentence is, nevertheless, flowers fall with our attachment and weeds spring up with our aversion. So Dogen is trying to say here that regardless of just what I said, actually, I think he's trying to say that, just what I said, that regardless of how deep our practice becomes, how good we become, we'll always be pining away for that last wave. And we'll always be worried about this next wave, but to some degree. We'll always be sad about people we lose, we love. I'm still sad about the sister I lost when, geez, what, more than 30 years ago. My sister's still alive, but I did lose. My sister's schizophrenia is very severe and has been for 35 years, so I lost my sister. I still feel sad about that wave. Even on that wave, you'd think that wave would have receded by now, wouldn't you? It's a big ocean. It's a big ocean, you guys. Huge. And there's always going to be another wave coming along. And so Dogen's saying that in spite of our wonderful Zen practice, when flowers fall, we're going to be sad. When weeds come up, we're going to say, oh, God. But can we just do that without making a federal case out of it? We want to make a federal case out of everything. We don't do that in Zen. We don't make a federal case out of it. Here it is. Here it is. Be with it. Be with it. That's all. Be with it. It's showing you the huge ocean, this wave. It's always expressing the huge ocean. Even if you think it's a 30-foot wave that's going to kill you, it's not. It's an expression of the huge ocean. You can surf it. Can surf it. That's what zazen is, surfing the ocean. With no surfboard. No surfboard. You have to go to some other religion to get a surfboard. We don't hand out surfboards. And to do this, it takes aspiration, as we were talking about in our Thursday study group. I send out questions for mornings. When I do study groups, I send out questions for people to answer. And usually I have an idea of what I'm looking for in terms of an answer. Occasionally I don't, but usually I do. And usually if I sit and listen long enough, I get the answer I want. But that's just the answer I want. I mean, what's the right answer? The right answer is one that that helps you in your aspiration, helps you in your practice, helps you in your life. That's the right answer. But I sent out a question about Martin Luther King's biographer. Martin Luther King's biographer said that Martin Luther King didn't hope because the odds looked good, but because they didn't. And that was my question. And you guys got it right. You got the right answer. I'm looking at Ben because he had the first right answer. And don't take me too seriously, you guys.
Don't worry.
Good, good. He didn't hope because the odds look good. He hoped because they don't. That's our way, you know? And how could the odds have looked good for him? When you think about the history of blacks in America, you think about the lynchings, you think about the disappearances, and he had the audacity to think that he could change that, the audacity to think that he could actually integrate those schools and those lunch counters and not die. Well, of course, he did die. Maybe he didn't care. I mean, I don't know. I don't know too much about the details. But the odds were completely against him. Completely against him. The odds are probably against you, too. If you tell me your life story, we'll cry together. And I'll see, yes, the odds are against you. So what? So what? Good. 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 Because when our aspiration is not based on an expectation, it's much more settled. It's much more free of measurement and comparison. We just come back to it. And that's, again, as what Ben said on Thursday, he took the last lines from my talk, which were to chant the four vows. So we do the four vows after the talk, right? Do the odds look good in these four vows to you guys? Do they look good? Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to attain it. Do they look good? Well, they are good, but they're not odds. Don't measure. They're good because if your aspiration is whole, is full, then already the Buddha Dharma is in your life, manifesting itself already, just through the aspiration. Just through the opening. So that's why Dogen says, at the end of this paragraph, the Buddha way transcends being and non-being. It transcends waves and ocean. Transcends them. Doesn't mean it gets away from them. It's just what is. That's all. Without hanging on one or the other. So in our Zazen practice, we sit still with our body, with our mind, with our breathing. Sometimes we have a lot of waves. Sometimes we don't have too many waves. And we just cultivate being at ease with those waves that are the ocean. And the more we can be at ease with whatever wave comes up, the less the wave will disturb us. It won't disturb us that much after we get used to it. And we'll actually experience it as the whole ocean. Even that negative wave, even that wave that is just out of control. It's not out of control because it's the ocean. It's the expression of the ocean. But let's not get too caught on some idea of ocean either. That sounds kind of mystical. Better just to go do the dishes or hang out with someone and have some lunch or something. Okay. That's what I want to say about that. Questions, comments? Questions, comments?
Well, let me start with one. You mentioned your sister. Mm-hmm. And a lot of, one of the assumptions in all this is that there's a calm ocean, with maybe ripples on the surface.
Uh-huh.
But what about people who have depression or some other, what advice do you have for working with those people, if you know them?
Well, those are the waves they've got, and they have a certain type of wave, a certain pattern of wave that has a lot of undertow to it, that has a persistent undertow, and that's their practice. That's their opportunity to see it as the ocean itself. And the stillness is always there. Even in the biggest wave, the stillness is always there. It's a question of just skillfully being there with it, trying to ride it, but not trying too hard, because you're not going to be able to stand up in a wave often. Often you have to body surf the wave, since we don't have boards. And often the wave's gonna somersault you. But can you just be with that turning? You can. You can. Your aspiration allows you to do that. Depression, schizophrenia. We and my other place of employment, my major place of employment. This is my place of non-employment, kind of, in terms of. Yeah, no, we won't get into that. In my place of employment, 3 years ago, we hired a director for one of our programs for people with serious and persistent mental illness who has severe chronic schizophrenia. We hired her to be the director. But we could tell that her practice, and she's not a Buddhist, so this isn't even about Buddhism. Her practice was such that she knew how to be with her waves, that she knew how to deal with the surf being up, and she could be calm with that and show other people how to be calm with it. She became our best program director, because all the clients who came in there knew that she had paranoid schizophrenia and had dealt with it for years. And the way she handled herself, the way she self-disclosed without spilling all over everybody, took her meds. Wonderful. Role model for me. Zen master beyond compare. No doubt about it. Yeah.
I was thinking when you were talking about the learning that's available in each moment and experience that my experience with depression is that it's easier in hindsight to say, see what I learned from that or wasn't that.
Yeah.
But it's much, much harder when you're in the midst of it.
Yes, and frankly, it is with all of these negative experiential moments. Depression, yes, but everything. I mean, I sure didn't see that as a teaching when my sister came, and I thought, my God, what did I get my wife and my kids into? What am I going to do? I didn't see that as a teaching. When did I see it as a teaching? I didn't even see it as a teaching when I'd run down to Zen Center to try to, I saw it as a teaching quite a bit later. But the point is that if we try to deal with it in calmness, keeping our Zen practice going, being steady, that it emerges as a teaching, and then it might take a year first to recognize it, or sometimes we can recognize it right away. I think it depends on, so whether it's depression or not, I think it's the same. Don't you?
Well, the lesson too about I get confused in this Western culture where we've been raised with some kind of Christianity in our soup. And the teaching is that God's got a plan. This has come to you because there's
It's God's will.
You're supposed to learn,
God's will. It was God's will that sent my sister to me. God, I don't want to want that kind of a God. Excuse me.
If it's hard to remove the God part,
right.
if something is enthusiastic,
that's right.
And try to just let teaching not have a value.
That's right. That's a very good point. It's a very good point. Yes. I was not raised in that kind of a culture, but I see that, especially in the Midwest. I was raised in a West Coast Unitarian culture, but I completely get what you're talking about. Other folks? Yeah.
Some of that same thing is that classic Christian prayer of, you know, may I have the wisdom to know the things that I can change or accept the things that
uh-huh.
I can change. You talk about two different situations in your talk, but Martin Luther King.
Uh-huh.
You can change the situation, and then also the other case of dealing with the situation just as it is.
Mm-hmm.
And not wrestling with it.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Well, I think there always has to be radical acceptance first. I think there has to be some moment when you just see it without fighting with it, and with radical acceptance, there's a possibility of change. I would like to think, and I don't know, that Martin Luther King had really come to terms with these issues of discrimination, of how he felt about it, how put down. He was, about how scary he was. It was for everybody, but certainly in Zen, it's the acceptance generates the possibility of change, and change without acceptance is we're never going to see the ocean. We're just going to be just one wave after another.
So, are you saying that?
Sure, I don't think it's that simple, but it sounds nice. I'll try. Yeah. I don't agree with that, but don't turn it into a formula. That's all. Yeah, tentatively, yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, he didn't think there was no way he could possibly accomplish it. If he thought there was no way that he could possibly accomplish it, that wouldn't be aspiration.
I guess what I was
he saying, hoped, even though the odds were not good, he hoped.
Okay. So, I was reading that as kind of going against this whole popular thing that we have mindset and teachings of this whole visualization thing that you visualize, that you're going to grant success. So is this, am I reading this that this is kind of a paradox? Or
I would say, yes, it's a paradox, and visualization is fine. Sometimes it's helpful. It's good to do, but it's not what really Dogen's talking about here. What he's talking about here is something more radical than that. Radical in terms of root. Radical means root, etymologically. Going to the root before we're splitting ourselves off from this experiential moment. But visualization can be helpful. That's the wave part of it. It can be helpful to visualize waves that are going to work in our lives. But if we get caught by any of that visualization, we forget it's all just the ocean. How's that? Okay. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit more about how we cultivate aspirations without letting them develop into expectations that we're going to become attached to?
Oh, boy. No. No. No, I can't. I'm just... That's hard, isn't it? That's hard. Usually when we start thinking a lot about the expectation, our aspiration is actually diminishing at that time, in the spiritual sense, in the Buddhist sense. When our aspiration is full, there's some expectation there, but it's what Katagiri Roshi used to said, it's more of a dim vision. If the vision becomes too strong, we're no longer open and still in this moment, because we're just... So the expectation is good, but the expectation is always changing anyway with our situation. So a fixed expectation is trying to make a permanent wave where there isn't one, because none of the waves are permanent. So if the expectation is too fixed, if it's strong to the point that I'm not able to be here with you because I'm thinking about what I'm going to do afterwards, then that expectation throws me off, so I've lost my aspiration. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Not to add too many more words to it, but as far as radical acceptance goes, would you agree that accepting even your past reactions to things, because you've got the teaching from the situation with your sister now,
right?
And if you hadn't reacted in that way at that time, maybe you wouldn't have. If you would have tried to be more zen about it, mm-hmm. then maybe you would have not gotten the teaching. I mean, everything is exactly as it is.
That's right.
It's perfect. It's just right. So
yeah,
the way you handled it was
yeah, sure.
right for you to receive the
yeah,
teaching.
Yeah, sure. But, I agree. Thank you. Yeah, that's right.
But why use words like perfect?
Huh?
Why use words like perfect?
Yeah.
Or complete or perfect. Or
yeah. At perfect, I tend to not use that word unless.
I was going to say because it connotes.
Yeah. Yeah. Although it's full of the Buddhist literature is full of it. I'm always trying to
full of it?
Empty of it. Empty of it. What else?
I was thinking from what they were saying that with the expectation or the visualization of, stepping back and just being with the process and not mm-hmm. necessarily worrying about the result.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that the result is important.
Mm-hmm.
It's only part of the process.
Good. Good. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well... Enjoy your ocean, and come tell me about how the surfing's going sometime. I always like to support you in your surfing, though I have access to no surfboards, so don't expect that.